I want you to take out a New Testament, turn to James, the first chapter, and in a few moments read with us from that passage. And our thoughts are entirely for this evening going to be centered upon some things that James says to us in James 1. No matter our educational background, no matter the job position or title that we hold, no matter the socioeconomic level on which we live, if we're a responsible person before God, no matter what age we are, how long we've been alive on the earth, whether we talk about Abraham, the father of our faith, or we think of David, the king, with whom God made a covenant that from his descendants, the eternal king would come into the world. Whether we're the Apostle Peter himself, or whoever else we might want to think about from top to bottom in the human experience, in spite of all the differences, we all have something in common. We've come to a certain moment of time in each of our lives. We've come to a crossroads, and we all know the feeling of having failed to do the right thing at that crossroads. When a moment of strong temptation has come to us, at some point or other, great or small, we have all succumbed and failed to do what is right in that moment. And I think that probably everyone here of a spiritual mind would say that we wished we had more wisdom, more self-control, more awareness of our circumstances to help us always choose to do what is right. To have insight and wisdom and self-control and an awareness of the moment that would help us see the nature of the temptation and choose the right path. Well, I'd like to talk to us tonight about that path. The choice that we have between continuing down the road of that which leads to sin and removing ourselves from that path and choosing to go down the path of righteousness. It's a choice we all have. But I think given certain circumstances, we make that choice extremely difficult long before the temptation ever arises. In James chapter 1, beginning in verse 12, James says, "Blessed is the man who endures temptation. For when he has been proved, he will receive the crown of life which the Lord has promised to those who love him." And such will life be here on the earth. It will be a time of testing. And again, it doesn't matter what age, it doesn't matter how long we've been a Christian, it doesn't matter the circumstances, testing is going to come. And if we can endure that testing and make the right choices, we will receive the crown of life. So verse 12 says. Sort of as a side point, I'm not going to focus on this tonight, but you notice that it's to those who love the Lord in verse 12 that this promise is made. And so there's something of an attitude that enters into this picture as to whether we will endure temptation in times of testing. James goes on, though, and explains more to us about this process of being tempted. "Let no one say, when he is tempted, I am tempted by God. For God cannot be tempted by evil, nor does he himself tempt anyone. But each one is tempted when he's drawn away by his own desires and enticed. Then when desire has conceived, it gives birth to sin, and sin, when it is full grown, brings forth death. Do not be deceived, my beloved brethren," and yet we're deceived frequently, it seems. We are deceived. We're deceived about this process, and we're deceived about the strength of temptation, and we're deceived about our own ability to withstand it. And so time after time after time, you and I both have succumbed, and we have chosen to go the wrong way and ended up hating ourselves for it in the end, much in the language that Paul describes in Romans chapter 7 as to his frustration that he felt and being presented with a choice to do right or wrong, knowing right, he chose to do wrong. It seems to me as we think about the temptations that come upon us at times, the reason that we often fail to make the right choice at the crucial moment is because we allowed the crucial moment to come. Sometimes when the full brunt of temptation is unleashed against us, it is too late at that point to resist. Too much has already happened. Too much momentum going in the wrong direction. Too much desire and not enough thought about God is already as water under the bridge. And we're now at a moment where Satan has us right where he wants us. And at that moment, that's usually when we really begin to think about what's at stake. And it's that moment often that we rue. We're so upset with ourselves that in that moment of intense temptation, we failed. And yet, perhaps at that moment, nobody could have survived. Although that's not technically true, I think. But we've made it awfully, awfully difficult for ourselves at that moment to resist. And so I think part of spiritual maturity is recognizing trends in our lives, recognizing direction, anticipating where this thing is going, and learning by experience to get ourselves off of that path before it reaches such a critical stage that we can no longer exercise self-control. It's been said of great outfielders, one of whom is Andrew Jones, that these fellas can anticipate where the ball is going to be hit before it's actually hit. And that sounds rather strange, almost sounds somewhat mystical. What's he doing? Reading the guy's mind? Well, I haven't played baseball in a long time, but I think what's happening is sometimes those outfielders can read the signal that the catcher is giving to the pitcher as to what kind of a pitch is going to be thrown. They watch the pitcher pitch enough to know if he's throwing a curveball, pretty much where he's going to try to put that curveball. And based on the angle of the baseball coming toward the batter, and even based on a batter's tendencies, the outfielder realizes if this pitch comes off the right way, it's going to be low and outside. And if the batter, following his tendency, swings at that pitch, more than likely, he's going to hit the ball in this direction. And so sometimes on television, you can actually watch an outfielder break toward the way the ball is going to go before the thing is hit. It's an amazing thing. But by watching, studying, doing homework, looking at certain other cues from the pitcher, from the batter, from the count, the call, and all of that, the circumstances of the runners on the base and where the batter might be trying to hit the ball, that outfielder sometimes starts running toward which way the ball is going to be hit before it's hit. Anticipation. And we need to do a similar thing when it comes to our behavior, when it comes to the choices that we're presented with. We need to anticipate. We need to see where this thing is going and honestly assess, if I don't change something, if I don't alter these events somehow, this is where I'm going to end up. I'm on a dangerous path. And so I'd like us to consider this chart. And what it represents at the top of the screen is the path of righteousness. This is the path God wants us on. This is the path that we ought to be following, choosing to do what is right every step of the way. The path towards sin is the bottom line. And you'll notice that we have this angled, and for a reason. I think as we go along, we're going to see why these two lines are divergent. And what I'm going to suggest are just observations that I have made. These are not absolute. You can erase. You can add to. But it seems to me that in studying my own behavior, the behavior of other people, looking at Bible examples, we can begin to identify some points along the way in which we have opportunity to change the course of events. For example, if we would simply exercise at times good judgment to make a better choice about the people that we're with, the activities that we're involved in, the job we take, the place we move, if we would exercise just the simple quality of good judgment, and this might not even be something that comes from a biblical standpoint, there are people in the world that exercise good judgment. They've learned about human behavior and human nature. Maybe they've learned about themselves. Or they've learned about trends, and they learn if you do this, that happens most of the time. Perhaps they're students of probability. And so there are people in the world that exercise good judgment to keep themselves out of bad situations. And so as we begin to find ourselves on a path that perhaps is taking us further and further away from the path of righteousness, it might be that we have early opportunity to get back on the right track simply by exercising good judgment. You know, this just isn't a good thing to be doing because of what might come from it. And you'll notice that what we're talking about on the left side of the screen represents that which is still closer to the path of righteousness than as we go further down the line to the right. In other words, the further on the path to sin we stay and the further down the line we go, the further it is back to the path that God would have us to be following. So we can get back to the path of righteousness by good judgment, just doing what would be the sensible thing to do. And then failing that, it might be that we've allowed ourselves to go a little bit further down the line in a direction that's not the best direction to be following. And at some point, we might just simply ask ourselves, you know, what is the safest course for me to be on? Are there things about this path that I'm on that, generally speaking, are helping me, encouraging me? Or do I find that as I'm on this particular part of the path, I'm being challenged? I'm being challenged to think things I ought not to be thinking. I'm being challenged to be around people doing things that I know are not right. I'm still okay. I'm not doing those things. But, you know, it's becoming more of a problem for me. There are just some things that are heading us toward the wrong direction. And it might be that if we would just stop and say, what is the safest course for me to follow in this situation? What is going to take me away from the growing stresses and strains that I feel in this particular path that I'm following? Well, it might be that we're not persuaded by good judgment. We miss that one. We miss that stepping off place. And it might be that, well, we've convinced ourselves not to follow a safe course and stay in this more risky direction for whatever reason that we're on that path. And then it might simply spare us to come to a point where we say, you know what? I'm getting it over my head. I've faced this before and I failed. I remember being here before. I remember being on this same path. And I failed. And you know what? This path that I'm following now, I'm being challenged by my friends. I'm being challenged by a number of other pressures being brought to bear upon me. And you know what? I'm just not sure I can deal with this. I know myself. I know my weaknesses. I know my tendencies. And you know what? I think I'm beginning to stretch my limits on what I can handle as a Christian. Well, at some point, perhaps past that, we might come to a more alarming stage. That as we've begun following this path, it's taking us further and further away from doing what is right. And I've passed on the opportunities to exercise good judgment and take the safe course and be honest about my limits and force myself, if you will, back to the path of righteousness. Now there comes a point where there's a voice in the back of my mind screaming at me, you are in danger. Maybe it's my voice, or maybe it's the voice of somebody else. Maybe it's a friend who's come to me in concern and they've said to me, you know what, I've noticed some things. They trouble me. I can't necessarily say you're in sin, but I think you're following a path that is taking you further away from God. And so whether it's the small voice in the back of our own minds, or whether it's feedback we're getting from others, or whether it's the teaching from our parents that's echoing in the back of our minds, warning us, there's a point at which we might, on some level, realize, I'm in trouble. I'm in a lot of trouble here. And then perhaps there's nothing to do at that point but to flee. You know, enough of trying to reason through it, enough of trying to tell ourselves we're strong enough to deal with it, enough rationalization over the matter. It just may be that at some point, I think Steve talked about this relative to fornication in the meeting last week, but simply put, with something as intense as fornication, we're just simply told to flee it. Get away from it. It doesn't matter whose feelings might be hurt. It doesn't matter about the friendships that might have to be broken. It doesn't matter about the job that might need to be terminated. It doesn't matter about the move I might need to make. At some point, we come to a place where sin is about to consume us. Or we feel ourselves getting weaker and weaker and weaker and almost, you know, being drawn into the black hole. And perhaps at that point, the only thing really there is to do is to just get away from the situation. Physically remove ourselves from it. And then try to work out the emotional after effects of that. Again, I don't know how technically correct those things are, but I do think this. I think that sin, the commission of sin, is a process. I think it's a process. It's a process that begins probably way before we think it does. And I think that there are steps that come to pass even before we get to this place that James is talking about where the temptation actually comes. This is beyond circumstances. We reach a point where it's not just, I just like being around these people and I like being involved in these activities. Perhaps that's not risen yet to the level of sinful attraction. Maybe it's just I'm choosing to be in an atmosphere that I enjoy, but I'm withholding myself from sin. I've got sin out here. But at some point, you know, that line is probably going to be crossed too. And what we're going to begin to find in our lives is, you know what, I really feel attracted to this situation, this person, this opportunity, this thing that's wrong. And you see what else is involved in this process usually is we know what is right and wrong. We're not usually being drawn down this path about things that we're totally ignorant of. These are often things that we know to be wrong, and yet they might not yet be full temptation, but the circumstances have conspired against me with my agreement to take me down a path where then temptation comes upon me. But you know what? Even at this point, we have some assurance. Even at this point, we have a way of escape. Turn back to 1 Corinthians chapter 10. And perhaps verse 12 of 1 Corinthians 10 applies to what we've already said. Therefore, let him who thinks he stands take heed lest he fall. Maybe that part of this reading should go with these preliminary steps. Because sometimes we continue down this path and we refuse to get off of it because we're overestimating our abilities. Or we're underestimating the devil, one of the two or both. I might think that I stand, therefore I can be in this situation, or I can be with these people, I can endure this, thinking all the while I'm strong and I can stand. It's going to look pretty silly if I remove myself abruptly from these circumstances. People are going to wonder what happened. Where did I go? Why don't you do this with us anymore? So sometimes we just lie to ourselves and are overconfident, telling ourselves that we can handle it, and we trudge right along down that stair step toward temptation. But in verse 13, Paul says, no temptation's overtaken you except such as is common to man, but God is faithful, who will not allow you to be tempted beyond what you're able. But with the temptation will also make the way of escape that you may be able to bear it. It is not uncommon to hear a person who's been overwhelmed in some sin to say, I don't know what happened. I just couldn't do anything about it. It just overwhelmed me. I didn't see it coming. Suddenly it was there, and I just didn't know what to do about it, and it was so strong, I just couldn't resist. That is a fairly common explanation given about sin. I just don't think it's often very realistic. Most of the time, I think a lot of jumping off points have been presented to us. We just didn't want to see them, or we weren't looking for them. But even at the moment of temptation, when I'm, as James says, drawn away by my own lust and enticed, sin has not yet occurred. Maybe I've not given my mind completely over to doing that act, as Jesus talks about a man who lusts in his heart for a woman's already committed adultery with her. Maybe I've not yet gone to that point because temptation is not sin. James makes that plain. That comes later. But now I find that my strong carnal desires are being engaged. And no longer is this a situation where I'm just trying to tell myself I can endure being near sin and it's not going to affect me. Now sin itself is drawing me and I'm having a hard time saying no. But even so, at that time of temptation, when we're drawn away by our lust and enticed, we have a way of escape. So says Paul. But this is the moment I said we've all come to at some point. Abraham, David, Peter, doesn't matter. Elders, preachers, deacons, it doesn't matter. We've all come to this point. And we have failed. And when we have, then, as James says, sin has resulted bringing forth death. Sometimes I think we stay on this course that, as we said, takes us further and further and further away. And I do think as you stay on the course towards sin, it gets harder. It gets harder to break this. The time to deal with this is way back on the left side of our chart here when we're not that deeply committed to that course. We're not that deeply involved yet. That's the time for good judgment and choosing the safe course. That's the time to hop off the train that's on the downward path. It gets harder as we get that momentum going downhill. But sometimes we stay on that path because our focus is too narrow. Sometimes I've heard people reason, well, where does the Bible say that it's wrong? Whatever it is that they're doing or considering or whatever activity is under consideration. Well, show me in the Bible where it says I can't do that. And I think that, you know, there's something of a ring of originality to that. Well, you know, I don't want to be thought to just be a traditionalist and just fall into practices that brethren have just assumed that are wrong. You know, you show me in the Bible where it says that's a sin. Well, you know, that's really not the only question to be asking in this process. There's more to it than, well, you know, is it a sin for me to be here with these people? Is it a sin for me to be doing this activity? Show me the Bible where it says I can't do that. Does the Bible say I can't? Sometimes we stay on this course because actually, deep down inside, we want to get down to that final outcome. The desire for sin is lurking within our hearts. We perhaps just don't recognize it. Sometimes it's overconfidence that he who thinks he stands, take heed lest he fall. We don't think that we're going to succumb to the temptation. Sometimes it's just pure denial. But for whatever reason, we often tend to stay on the downward path until it's too late. Well, you can think of your own scenario. I'll suggest a couple. And this happens, you know, to young and old, as I said before. The temptation to lie. Dad says to Junior, "You know, I don't want you playing baseball in the house. You might break something." Well, Dad's not here. And I know he told me not to play baseball, but he didn't say not to play tennis that's in the house. So I get out the tennis ball. And I begin swatting that thing around. You know, parents have an uncanny sense of anticipation, don't they, when it comes to their children. It ain't real hard to look down the road and see that if Junior keeps doing this, something bad's probably going to happen. And sure enough, Junior's swatting the tennis ball around, and he breaks Mom's flow blue china hanging on the wall. And then he decides that rather than face the music, he'll just get out the crazy glue and fix it because Mom is so dumb, she will never figure this out. And of course, Mom figures it out. And she comes to Junior and says, "Who broke my flow blue china?" "Not me." Where did the temptation to lie start? When Mom came and stood over Junior and said, "Who broke my flow blue china?" I tell you, in that moment of self-preservation, the tendency is going to be very, very strong to lie. Because that's the reason I didn't own up to it in the first place. I knew it would be bad if I did. And I'm not just making this up. This is from experience. Only it was a Liberty Bell lamp that I chipped and glued back together. But where does the temptation to lie start? Does it not start way before breaking the flow blue china or way before breaking the lamp with a lot of other decisions along the way that weren't the best ones? Good judgment? Was it good judgment to say he said a baseball, he didn't say a tennis ball? Was it the safe course when I could have just gone outside with the tennis ball and batted the thing against the side of the house or found somebody to play tennis with? Wouldn't that have been a much safer course? I'm not going to break that lamp or that flow blue. Know your limits. Know what your own tendencies are. That when you begin swatting something around the house, likely the ball isn't going to go where you intend for it to go. I mean, in that scenario, didn't the lying and the tendency to lie begin long before Mom came and began accounting for what happened? And would Junior not have saved himself a lot of grief by dealing with the situation in a better way beforehand? But such is youthfulness, right? Poor old Junior's just not smart enough to figure this out yet, right? Well, let's take the teenager. Well, you know, all my friends are going out, and, you know, we're going to be going to here and there, and, you know, we might be out past midnight, but, you know, it's not wrong to be out past midnight. It's not sinful. What's the big deal about being out, you know, at 12:15 as opposed to 11:45? It's just, you know, hands on the clock. So it's not wrong for me actually to be out. Come on, Mom, let me stay out with my friends past midnight. There's nothing wrong with that. Well, you know, there's nothing wrong with being with the friends that I'm going to be with. They're not Christians, Mom and Dad. They're not Christians, but. Well, and yeah, some of them, they do some things that they shouldn't be doing, but I don't do that stuff. So are you telling me that it's wrong for me just simply to be with people who are doing things when I'm not doing that? I mean, after all, who do you expect me to hang around? Seems like everybody's doing something they ought not to be doing. So I'm not going to be drinking or anything like that, but, you know, it's not wrong for me to be around people that are doing that. And perhaps with or without your parents' permission, you find yourself in the company of those people past midnight. And sure enough, somebody pops the top on a can and begins to drink, but you're not doing anything wrong. But then they begin making fun of you. urging you. Oh, come on. Your parents aren't here now. Come on, just you, take a drink. It's not going to hurt anything. Well, you know, if I just taste it, I don't really, you know, guzzle it. But if I just taste it, well, you know, what's so wrong about that? And so you taste it and you find out what alcohol really tastes like. But you know, you take another drink, even though it's horrible, not because you like it, but because of the social pressure. And then a drunk driver comes across the lane and runs into the car that you're in with your friends head on. Someone is killed. You have alcohol in your breath. Beer cans are found in the car. You're out past midnight. You know, when did those problems start? When did the problem start? And in a situation like this, we don't usually ask enough questions, that we don't ask the right questions. Where does the Bible say I can't be out with my friends? If they're drinking and I'm not. Show me where it says. I'm not drunk. When in fact, there's been so many stages along the way heading toward disaster that we could have gotten off that train by just wise judgment or taking the safe course or knowing our limits or looking down the road at what kind of things might happen. Exercising just common sense judgment. We read about these things in the paper all the time. And we might say to ourselves, you know, what were they doing in that situation? How did they let themselves get in that situation in the first place? Not enough of the right questions were dealt with at some point along the line. A third scenario. Man needs a secretary, so he interviews several females for the position and he hires the prettiest one. Maybe she's the most qualified. Doesn't hurt that she's pretty good looking. Nothing wrong with that. Got to work with people all the time. And I just have to control myself in this close association I'm going to have with this woman in our working relationship. And along the way, work is intense, time is short, the opportunity comes along for us to have lunch together. Nothing wrong with that. I might even tell my wife ahead of time, I'm going to have lunch with my secretary today. You know, we're under a big crush of work, and I just don't think I'm going to be able to get out, and neither is she, so we're just going to have a quick lunch together. Nothing going on. There's nothing wrong with that. And while we're having lunch, we just get some downtime and start relaxing a little bit. And, you know, secretary has really shown an interest in me along the way, and we seem to have a good rapport. And so I begin talking to her about some of the problems I'm having at home, some of the marital issues that have come up. It's not wrong to talk to somebody about stresses and strains that you're feeling, difficulties. And she's shown such good judgment, and she really seems to care about me as a person. And so confiding in her, certainly not wrong. In fact, it just might enhance my marriage. And then, lo and behold, the trial gets closer, the deadline gets closer, whatever, and we're having to work late at certain times. Well, nothing wrong. Send everybody else home, give them, you know, some freedom, get home to their families, and secretary and I will work together and try to clean up some of the mess. And you know, she worked so hard, and finally we've met the deadline, and we've been strained and exhausted and sharing back and forth, and so as we're about to part our separate ways, I lean over and give her a kiss on the cheek, say, job well done. Nothing wrong with that. Nothing wrong with kissing a woman on the cheek who's not your wife. Just a social custom. Okay, stop and insert here. Do you see where this is headed? Because as we describe this more clinically, we all can see where this is headed. Nobody here is fooled about where this is headed. But he is. Because he's been lying to himself the whole time. And not asking the right questions. And not asking enough of those questions. Or does the Bible say I can't have lunch with my secretary? Or does the Bible say I can't just give an appreciative peck on the cheek to my coworker? Or does the Bible say I can't do that? Where does the Bible say? The Bible says a lot about foolishness in Proverbs and what leads to situations like this. But when in the back of our minds, as we lie to ourselves, in the back of our minds, what we're saying is, I really do enjoy the time I spend with this pretty secretary that I've hired. And you know what? I knew I would when I hired her. You see, that sometimes is going on in the back of our minds, but, you know, we just kind of suppress that. And just like sheep led to the slaughter, we're right down the path that Solomon in Proverbs does talk about the foolish man who's enticed by the siren. Well, then, sometimes the working relationship goes exactly where we know it goes. On a business trip together, well, that's not wrong. Well, you know, the hotel, the convention was in town, and they messed up our room assignment, and all they've got left is a two-room suite. Well, there's nothing wrong with that. She's got her bedroom, and I've got mine. And, you know, this is totally platonic. But before we each go to our bedroom, how about a game of backgammon? And she comes out in her silk pajamas and her robe, and we sit and play a game of backgammon and just have a fun time. A fun time was had by all. And then we're trying to explain to our wife how it all happened so quickly. I don't know what happened, dear. It just overwhelmed me, and it was so... I just lost my head. I don't know what happened, but I just found myself in a situation. She threw herself at me with the silk pajamas. You know, how many opportunities do we have along the way to step off of this train? It's heading toward the edge of the cliff, and opportunity after opportunity after opportunity is given to us to exercise that free will we've got and do what is right. But in the hotel suite, away from home, overworked and overstressed, with someone who just seems to connect with my needs, that's not the time to try to resist temptation. Although we should try to resist. But most of the time, you know what is going to happen in that circumstance. And so, the lesson tonight is just simply this one main point. Take the opportunity that's presented to us, or one of them, because there are many. Take the opportunity to get off of the path that you're on, perhaps, that's leading you further and further away from doing what is right. Be honest with yourself. Be honest with God. Be honest with the people that you're involved with. And stop the process while you still have a chance. I think Peter's sin was a process, his denial of the Lord. It's an interesting study to see how Satan intensified the pressure on Peter gradually. We tend to think those three denials came boom, 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 back to back. They didn't. There was time in between those. And Peter did not exercise the choice that he had to remove himself from that situation. David, in his sin with Bathsheba, had ample opportunity to step away from that. And he chose not to do it. And so it is oftentimes for us. As spiritually minded and hopefully mature Christians, we must ask other questions besides, where does the Bible say it's wrong? We must ask, is it wise? Is it safe? Is it dangerous? Is it leading me toward greater danger? Is it enhancing my spirituality? Does it make it easier for me to be pure in thought? Can I glorify God in what I'm thinking and what I'm intending in the circumstance that I'm in now? Does it honor my wife, my husband? Is the activity that I'm choosing, is the interaction, the conversation I'm having, is that something that treasures and honors my spouse? Could I be doing the same thing with my spouse present? Or any other sinful tendency that we find ourselves
in.
The sad part of all of this is oftentimes the wisdom to avoid it only comes from the failure. We have to go through this and realize that we're not as strong as we thought we were. We did not get out of the situation what we thought we would get out of it. We find ourselves in the throes of not just remorse or guilt, but the damage done to the relationship by the bad choice that we made. And through that kind of pain and misery, sometimes we come to learn something about wisdom and choosing the safe course and recognizing our limits. I'm sure God at times thinks, woe is me, if only my people would choose to do right before they're overwhelmed with a temptation. Maybe we're talking directly to somebody tonight. I don't have any inside information. But it may be that we're talking to you. If there's a situation that you're fighting, you feel the draw and you feel the pull in a direction that's further and further away from godliness. Please think about what has been said tonight. And think about the power that Satan has and the weakness that we often display. And ask yourself, if you don't change the path that you're on, where are you going to end up? What is it going to produce? And if you look at your own life and you say, you know what? He is talking to me. And I have been fighting this. It doesn't mean you have to come to the front tonight and make a confession of something that's a private matter. If it'll help you for someone else to know the situation and help you and pray about it, and you need the strength of other people to, maybe you've gone so far down the line, you don't think you got the strength anymore to get out of it. There are people here that will help you. The elders will help you on a private basis. We as a congregation would help you on a public basis. What's important at this point, if we are speaking to somebody here directly tonight, is not pride. It's not maintaining an image or an impression. It's fleeing sin and getting off of the path that's going to lead to destruction if it's not changed. So that's our urging. Is there any way we can help you with what you're struggling with? If you have the courage to be honest about where you are, we urge you to pray, study, honestly consider where you are, and reach out for help if you need help. Is there some way we can serve you while we're standing and singing?